On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC's Sediment Cap Chemical Isolation, which is an introduction to the ITRC online resources produced by ITRC in 2023. My name is Taylor Vogel, and I will be your moderator for today. I now have the pleasure of introducing our trainers. All of them served as members of the team and volunteered to support the training offered today. Before we get started, just a quick note, some of the links presented in today's training may be broken or out of date. If you run into any issues accessing a link, you can always navigate directly to the main guidance document and use the table of contents to find the specific sections we're referencing. At this time, I will hand it off to Ashley from the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy.
Thank you. I'm excited to welcome you all to our webinar today about the sediment cap chemical isolation guidance that was published in 2023. There are a number of technical references that are available that discuss different sediment remediation approaches and sediment capping specifically. One of those is our 2014 contaminated sediment remediation guidance that ITRC previously developed. Many of these technical reference materials remain valid and are helpful for understanding sediment capping, but they tend to have a higher level focus. For example, the 2014 ITRC guidance provides a high-level overview of sediment remediation technologies, and it summarizes the key factors that should be considered when evaluating different cleanup options. One of the chapters of the 2014 ITRC guidance is dedicated to capping, and it provides useful information for deciding whether or not capping could be an effective remedial approach for any given site. Our team supports the information in the 2014 guidance, and we believe it's a valuable resource for projects that are in the alternatives analysis and remedy selection process. Our 2023 sediment cap chemical isolation guidance was developed to expand upon ITRC's 2014 guidance with the goal of improving consistency in the project phases that follow remedy selection. Our goal for the guidance was to go into detail about the design, construction, and performance monitoring for the chemical isolation function of caps, and to create a framework that encourages more consistent designs and performance outcomes for caps. I'll let Warda continue with an overview of our training for today.
Thanks, Ashley. I'll start by going over the roadmap for today's training. I'll briefly cover the introduction from section one of the guidance document, and trainers speaking after me will cover content from the remaining sections of the guidance listed here. As Ashley mentioned, the 2014 guidance covered remedy selection for contaminated sediment sites in great detail, and the graphic shown here on the right outlines the general process to be followed when capping has been selected as part of your remedy. You will see this graphic throughout the training, as each trainer will use this graphic to identify where we are in the process and which sections of the guidance are related to a particular step in the process. Okay. You may have noted that section four was missing from the previous slide. This training will not specifically cover section four of the guidance. However, data needs from section four will be touched on throughout the training as they inform all aspects of our discussion today. Section four mainly consists of table 4-1, a snapshot of which is shown here on this slide, which summarizes data needs to support chemical isolation layer design, modeling, construction, and monitoring. And you can access this table and the associated data needs in the online guidance. So sediment capping objectives shown here include physical stabilization to provide physical isolation and prevent particulate transport, chemical isolation to limit migration and release of dissolved contaminants from underlying sediment, and the protection of benthic communities by preventing direct contact with underlying contaminated sediments. These objectives are the same as the 2014 guidance. However, today's training and the accompanying 2023 guidance focus on the chemical isolation function of caps specifically. And with that, I'll give it over to Bhavna.
All right, thanks, Varda. All right, section two, capping overview. This section basically provides details on capping objectives and particularly the chemical isolation function of the cap. So capping can be a single layer or a multi-layer system of clean materials or a combination of materials or amendments to meet the objectives that Bertha has just described. The three primary objectives of physical stabilization, chemical isolation, and protection of benthic community. And these objectives are generally interrelated and can be combined to achieve the site-specific performance objectives. Now, if site conditions are conducive, then a single layer cap may serve multiple functions and achieve all these performance objectives. But in some cases, a series of layers may be required. And in this slide, we have a multi-layer cap system, and we'll go through the function of each of these cap layers. Now, although this guidance is mainly focused on the design of chemical isolation layer, it is important to understand the entire cap configuration because these different cap layers, they do contribute to the design of chemical isolation layer. And Deirdre will elaborate further in the following section as well. So let's take a look at the configuration of this multi-layer cap system here. The first layer that is placed right on top of contaminated sediment, where mixing or consolidation can occur, is the base or leveling layer. This layer creates an even or stable base on which rest of the cap layers can be placed. And it basically prevents mixing of chemical isolation layer with the contaminated sediment. It adds geotechnical stability and improves cap constructibility. Then chemical isolation layer, this layer is designed to inhibit migration of contaminants from underlying sediment. And that can generally occur via advection, diffusion, dispersion, bioturbation, or gas ablation. And design of this layer depends on the nature of contamination and hydrodynamic conditions. Then filter layer, this layer is intended to mitigate any mixing of chemical isolation layer from the upper erosion protection layer. And this layer is typically used when there is a difference in grain size between these two layers and is typically constructed with medium-sized grain material or geosynthetics that serves as a transition layer. Then erosion protection layer, it's also known as armor layer. This layer is intended to protect physical integrity of the chemical isolation layer from the anticipated erosive forces that can be caused by hydrodynamic conditions or navigational traffic. Now, it is important for the sites where there is a potential for cap disturbance due to these high erosive forces. Even for the low energy environment, a minimal protection or cover may be required. And this layer can be constructed from a range of coarse grain material or some manufactured materials. Now, design of this layer is not a part of this guidance, but there are some references provided where you can find that information. Habitat restoration layer, this is the uppermost layer that accommodates benthic community after recolonization. The requirements for this layer is project specific and could be driven by permits and ERRs. This layer may require suitable stone size or a particular grain size or even addition of some substrate to promote benthic life. Composition and thickness of this layer could be project specific. If fines are used, then we might need to consider a thicker layer to account for any losses or of sacrificial material. And there is a possibility that we might even need to replenish this layer based on the project specific requirements. Now, I'll just emphasize this surface of the cap constitutes BAZ, which is biologically active zone, and it will be referred throughout the training. Now, a range of cap configurations and materials can be used to accomplish performance objectives depending on the site conditions. The first column is same as the previous slide showing all the cap layers. Second column represents a scenario where a base layer may not be required. For example, for some of the dredge and cap projects, this layer may be required to stabilize dredge residuals prior to capping. But in some cases, we may decide to place amendments directly after dredging to address any residual contamination, and a separate base layer may not be required. Then third column shows a separate habitat restoration layer may not be required. And this could be the case if the erosion protection layer material provides a suitable habitat for recolonization, or even if the site is depositional, then a distinct habitat layer may not be required unless there is a project-specific requirement for this layer. Fourth column represents a scenario where a filter layer may not be required, and this can be evaluated based on the material we select for the chemical isolation and erosion protection layer. Then this last column, this represents a single layer cap system, where a single layer may serve multiple functions and can achieve more than one objective. This could be for the sites where there is a low potential for chemical migration. And in that case, a layer of clean materials such as sand or gravel can be used to basically create a physical barrier that can prevent direct contact for potential receptors from the contaminated sediment. And in that case, a multi-layer cap system may not be required. So in the previous slides, we reviewed single layer cap, single cap layer or a combination of cap layers that can be designed to meet the specific site-specific performance objectives. The three most commonly referenced cap types are unamended granular caps, low permeability caps, and amended caps. And these are basically based on the type of material we use for the chemical isolation function of the cap. Unamended granular caps, they are typically constructed with inert materials such as sand, stone, or other natural materials. These caps are permeable in nature, and they are generally intended to provide physical separation and increase the attenuation thickness, isolate contaminants by preventing any direct contact of benthic organisms, with the contaminated sediment. Low permeability caps, these are typically constructed of clay-based materials or geosynthetic liners. And these materials are designed to provide relatively impermeable or low permeability barrier that reduces the advective flux of contaminants. And these caps also provide physical separation and impedes upward flow of cool water and migration of contaminants. Now, amended caps, these caps are consist of a wide range of reactive amendments. These caps are typically permeable that allows upward flow of cool water and retard chemical migration. Selection of amendment that depends on the site-specific conditions and contaminants. For organic contaminants, typically activated carbon and organophilic clay-based amendments are used. If NAPL is present, then a combination of amendments could be used where organophilic clay could be used to address NAPL and activated carbon to address any dissolved phase contaminants. For sites with heavy metals, amendments such as apatite, zeolite, or siderite are typically used. And in section two of this guidance, there is a table that summarizes all these different amendments. Then there are different placement techniques. These amendments can be either mixed with granular materials such as sand, or they can be applied in bulk in formulations that are commercially available, or they can be placed even in mat-based forms. We also have cap models that have capability to evaluate these different amendments and commercially available formulations, and that will be covered in this training as well. Cap design considerations. So this slide illustrates four critical design factors, and that will be covered throughout the training. Chemical design criteria. It is important for the evaluation of chemical isolation layer thickness and selection of amendments that depends on type of contamination, level of contamination, and hydrodynamic conditions. Physical design constraints. It's important for us to understand for the design and constructability of caps, how the site settings are, what the navigational requirements are, any geotechnical concerns, any presence of debris or structure, any particular habitat requirement. Then we need to have an understanding of hydrodynamic conditions, any erosion potential, or any slope stability concerns. Then permitting, it is important to understand permitting requirements and ERRs in the initial planning phase, as this there could be some requirements that may need to be considered during the design as well as at the time of CAP construction. Then lastly, constructability. It is important to understand constructability requirements from the initial design phase and to understand how the CAP will be constructed and if there will be any construction constraints so that CAP can be constructed as designed and specified. And with that, I'll pass it over to Deirdre.
Thanks, Bhavna. So as Bhavna was just showing, there are different types of CAP configurations, different amendments that may be needed to meet your site goals. And when designing a chemical isolation layer and defining what that thickness is going to be or whether amendments are needed, we often turn to models. And Danny Reibel's going to get into the modeling later in this training. But before we dive into the modeling, we first need to understand what we're designing the CAP to protect and also what other considerations need to be taken into account. So, in this section, which corresponds to section 3 of the guidance document, we're going to cover design criteria and other key considerations. So, when we talk about performance targets, the goal is to reduce risk to human health and ecological receptors. And we refer to these as remedial action objectives or RAOs. And as you can see from these examples, RAOs are broad in nature. So, for example, I'll take the first one, which is human health. Reduce risks to adults and children from incidental ingestion and dermal exposure and consuming contaminated fish and shellfish. So you can see these are broad, but when we design a CAP, we need our criteria to be more specific and we need it to be quantitative. So that's where the design criteria come into play. The design criteria are requirements that the CAP must satisfy. And we can break those down into the questions of what, where, and when. So, when we talk about the what, we're talking about either concentrations that we need to meet or a flux reduction we need to meet. When we get into the where, we're talking about the depth of compliance or point of compliance. So, the depth within the chemical or the depths that the chemical isolation performance targets apply. The where is also spatial scales. So, surface weighted average concentrations or SWAC. Basis over the specified area, or maybe you have to meet your criteria on a point by point basis. And then finally, we get into the when. And so the when is the time frame that the chemical isolation performance targets apply, and we refer to that as our design life. So here's a few examples. When you read each one, you'll see that each of these has components to it that answer those questions of what, where, and when. So if I take the first one, the pore water concentration of contaminant X shall not exceed 1 nanogram per liter. So that's the what. It shouldn't exceed that at a depth of 10 centimeters. That's the where. And then over 100 years, and that's the when. And so if you look at each of these examples, each of them have those components of the what, the where, and the when. And so that allows us a quantitative way of evaluating the CAP performance. So here I'd like you to think about potential issues you've encountered when establishing the remedial goals at your site. One example that I'm going to get into is uncertainty when the design criteria are based on a solid phase concentration. And that's particularly true for organic compounds. And on the next slide, I'll show you what I mean. So here we're talking about the what. And as I mentioned, the what could be a specific concentration or a flux that needs to be met. So in the case if we're designing, the design criteria are based on concentration, we have two options. The criteria could be on a pore water basis, or it could be on a solid phase basis. And so when evaluating the performance of a cap, either during design or later in monitoring after it's constructed, it's really helpful for the design criteria to be on a pore water basis. And that's because the presence of organic carbon in the cap itself will influence the concentrations on a solid phase basis. And so it's just easier to understand if a cap is performing as expected if the criteria is on a pore water basis. And I'll show you what I mean with this example. So on the left, this is, you can see a graphic of the cap profile. So we have our sediment, above that we have a layer of sand, and above that we have what we call a biologically active zone. Then there's a graph. This is output from a CAPSIM model. On the y-axis we have depth, so that corresponds to like the depth of those cap components. And on the x-axis we have concentration, and it's pore water concentration, micrograms per liter. And so you can see as you move from the sediment to the sand to the biologically active zone, concentrations are decreasing as you move towards the surface. And there's a little call out that shows you, that zooms in on that biologically active zone. So you can see the concentrations decreasing. Now, the graph on the right is the same exact model simulation, but the results are on a sorbed phase basis or a solid phase basis. And again, using that little zoomed in circle to the right, you can see that the concentrations in the biologically active zone, that BAZ, are affected by what we assumed the total organic carbon would be. And so the higher the total organic carbon is in that layer, the more sorption that's going to happen, and then that concentration becomes higher. And also, if we assume the TOC is lower, that the concentration is lower, right? So knowing what that TOC is and what it's going to be in the future is really important if you're going to look at things on a sorbed phase basis. So by setting your design criteria to a pore water concentration, you can avoid that effect. So another complicating factor for designing a cap and your and defining your design criteria are background concentrations. So in dynamic environments, the background concentrations affect the surface sediment, and hence they affect the surface of the cap. So this graphic on the left shows a cap on top of sediments with no deposition. I've overlaid an X and Y axis on top of this graph. And so the pink line at the bottom represents the concentrations in the sediment to pore water. So if I click here, you'll start to see that the concentrations. Sorry. Yep, you'll see that the concentrations are moving up through the cap. And then on the right, yeah, sorry. This example is now showing how deposition will affect that. And so this is where we have deposition and the depositing particles have an elevated COC concentrations. So as I move through this, you'll see that the concentrations at the surface are being affected by the concentrations in that depositing particles. So knowing what your background concentrations are may help you define realistic criteria. And these graphics also highlight the difference between cap effectiveness and remedy effectiveness. So in both cases, the cap may be working as intended, and that's what we refer to as cap effectiveness. In both cases, the cap is resulting in concentrations decreasing as they're migrating up through the cap. But in the case on the right, although the cap is performing as expected, The remedy may not be performing, and you may not have cut off the source. And so, remedy effectiveness versus CAP effectiveness is an important distinction, particularly during long-term monitoring after the CAP is constructed. And tomorrow we'll get into that later in this training. So the next question that we want to answer is the where. So we can talk about the where as the point of compliance. And the point of compliance is directly related to our remedial goals. So this is a graph that shows a CAP with a chemical isolation layer and an erosion protection layer or habitat layer. And in this case, the same layer is serving both those functions, both habitat and erosion protection. So, for remedial goals that are established to be protective of benthic organisms, the point of compliance is within or at the bottom of that biologically active zone, because this is the zone where benthic organisms are going to live and feed. Now, for remedial goals that are established to be protective of ambient water quality criteria or fish at higher trophic levels, representative surface water conditions, the point of compliance is near the CAP surface where the chemicals will flux to the surface water or in the surface water itself. Now, a concept that is discussed in the 2023 guidance is the design evaluation depth. And this is the depth at which you will design the CAP to meet the target criteria. So, this is an example of a CAP designed to be protective of benthic organisms. And therefore, the point of compliance is again in that biologically active zone. The design evaluation depth may be the same as that point of compliance. But depending on the capped environment, there may be reasons to design the cap to assess performance at depths other than your point of compliance. And some of these reasons include the presence of large armstone or confounding effects from deposition. And I'm going to get to some examples in the next few slides. So this is an example of a cap with large armstone. You can see that large armstone at the top of the cap. You can, I mean, this is for illustration purposes, but you can see that there's lots of void space, and the void space has a lot of surface water in it. So the large armstone is therefore not likely to provide attenuation of your chemicals. The large pore space is more representative of surface water unless it fills in from depositing material. So in this case, where you have large armstone that's not filled in, it may be more appropriate to evaluate CAP effectiveness below that armstone. So in this case, it would be like in that filter layer. So continuing with that same example of a CAP that's designed to be protective of benthic organisms. So once the CAP is placed, the benthic organisms will start to reoccupy the top of the CAP. So that biologically active zone is at the top of the cap, and the point of compliance is again in that biologically active zone. So now we're going to consider deposition. So with deposition over time, so in this graphic, we're looking from left to right on the graphic, the point of compliance rises as that biologically active zone continues to transition into that newly deposited material. So, if the depositing material is clean, it may contribute to natural recovery and then provide that additional attenuation. So, in this case, you may choose this as your design evaluation depth as well. However, you also may choose a design evaluation depth that is deeper, avoiding the influence of those depositing particles or that depositing material. And so, by doing this, you would be assessing the effectiveness of the chemical isolation layer alone to provide your attenuation. So, even if designing a cap to meet criteria at this deeper depth, you could also understand the anticipated concentrations in your biologically active zone, and that will just help to set expectations for later, perhaps like during monitoring. So now this is an example that combines the last two concepts. So it's large Armstrong, but it's also filled in from that position. And so in this case, with the infilling, it'll behave similar to the deposition example that I just showed on that last slide. So again, you can, set your design evaluation depth to either the point of compliance or to a deeper depth. That deeper depth B, which avoids the influence of the depositing particles and evaluates the effectiveness of the chemical isolation layer. All right, so now we move on to the question of when. And the design life answers the question when or for how long. The design life is the minimum period over which the cap is designed to meet the target criteria. So caps are designed to provide long-term risk reduction. So a typical design life that is widely accepted is 100 years. Could be shorter depending on your circumstances. So this graph shows an example output from CAPSIM. The blue line shows the predicted concentrations at a depth of 5 centimeters from the surface of the cap, and it shows this over a 100-year simulation. In this example, the cap was designed to meet the criteria, which is shown as the pink horizontal line. And it's doing that for 100 years. And you'll see that the concentrations at 100 years, so that blue line, are still less than the criteria and are expected to remain less than the criteria for more than 100 years. So, although we designed a cap for 100 years, which is its design life, its performance life may be longer, especially when you take conservatism into the design process. And there's a number of factors that add conservatism to a cap design. And I'll get to those here. And so there's a number of ways that conservatism is built into the design along throughout the entire process. We'll start with the design criteria. A lot of times we perform risk assessments, and there's conservatism built into those risk assessments. When we do the modeling, the input parameters, we build conservatism in there. Some of the inputs to the models that have the largest influence on results are the groundwater seepage rates and the contaminant concentrations. Again, we may try to be more conservative with those inputs. Again, partitioning characteristics have a big impact on the results and deposition rates if you have deposition at your site. Then we move on to the material specifications during design. So this is where we would specify a minimum thickness and an amendment dose to meet the criteria. Again, we can be conservative there. And then when we get into the actual construction, and the placement of these materials, the contractor may place more than what's specified just to ensure that they meet the criteria for or the specs for the construction and the placement of those materials. All right, so now that we've gone through the process of defining the design criteria, we want to consider other factors that may impact the design of a cap. So we want to know if there are any constraints on cap thickness. Some examples might be that you need to, keep the cap thin for flood control, or you may have navigation requirements. In this example, I'm going to use navigation as the example. And so due to navigation purposes, we may have to maintain a minimum water depth. Right. So that means that we're only left with a certain height or thickness remaining for the cap placement. So let's just zoom in now on that what's left or what's remaining for the cap. So now consider that other layers are needed and how much room we have left for the chemical isolation layer. And this is referred to in the 2023 guidance as the top-down approach. So we may need a base layer, right? If we need to create an even surface. I think Bhavna talked about that in the last section. We want to protect the chemical isolation layer, so we need armor layer. Depending on the difference in size of what our chemical isolation layer is going to be and the size of the armor layer, we might also need a filter layer. And so then that leaves us with how much room is remaining for that chemical isolation layer. And so if that thickness isn't sufficient, we may need an amendment or, to maintain that thinner thickness, or we might need to dredge to, create more room. So in talking about the amendments, so cap amendments are often required to meet the performance targets. Amendment types depend on your chemicals of concern. You can have a combination of amendments that may be needed. It really depends on what chemicals are at your site. You might have an amendment that's needed for an organic chemical, and then you might also need a different amendment that works for like a metal, for example. These amendments can be placed in discrete layers, they can be mixed with other materials, or they can be added directly to the sediment. We do recommend data collection to support the modeling for the cap design. And then also when considering these amendments and where they're going to be placed, you also want to consider the benthic community impacts. There are some literature that may indicate some toxicity, again, depending on where the amendment is in relationship to where the benthic organisms will be. All right, so section 3.4 of the guidance document provides a comprehensive list of like other considerations. Listed here are just a few of the fundamental characteristics to consider, but I encourage you to read section 3.4 for more information. So when designing a cap and kind of setting up, how you're going to design it, you might want to understand the spatial differences at the site that can affect your chemical isolation layer. This might help you to optimize your cap design, particularly if you like need a very robust cap. Maybe you can limit the area which that robust cap will need to be designed based on maybe differences in chemical concentrations, the contaminant distribution. And this includes geochemistry, which can also be important for some chemicals. Maybe there's a spatial difference in NAPL presence. You could have differences in your seepage rates. Again, that seepage rate is a key parameter for cap design. And then you might have different parts of the site which have deposition and erosion potential. And then finally, we want to think about the benthic community structure and the bioturbation. So bioturbation depths of 5 to 10 centimeters are common. But site-specific data may be needed from benthic surveys to inform the model, and also the depth over which that bioturbation occurs and where those benthic organisms are living and feeding may also inform that point of compliance. So to wrap up this section, we talked in detail about the design criteria, and with each question of the what, the where and the when, we discussed complicating factors and how we might handle those. We also spoke about design constraints with an example of that top-down approach with that navigation limitation example. And then finally, we gave a few examples of other site characteristics that should be considered for the chemical isolation layer design. And again, there's a lot of information there in section 3, so I do encourage you reading that. And with that, I'll introduce Danny Reibel, who's going to talk about the chemical isolation layer modeling.
Thank you, Deirdre. I appreciate the opportunity to build on the topics that she's been discussing and that the other team members have been discussing and say, well, okay, we've talked about models and various aspects. How are we going to make that work and make sure that I am controlling the slide. So how are we going to make that work with an actual design modeling? So we're going to talk about some of the aspects of translating this conceptual model, the conceptualizations that we've been talking about into a model, and without a lot of the details, but to give you at least an overview of that process. We're going to address, well, why are we using a CAP model as opposed to some other sort of model? What models are available? What are the key things that we should be focused on to ensure that our results are valid? And that is related as well to what is the model most sensitive to? What are the most uncertain parameters? So some of the things that we might do with a model is, we have a design criteria. We have a location that we're going to use to evaluate our design. Well, how thick of a contaminant isolation layer do we need to be able to achieve those goals? What are the composition of that? We're going to add an amendment like activated carbon. How much carbon are we going to need? And again, evaluate some of the sensitivity to these is that if we miss that carbon match, or if we end up with are our results sensitive to that composition or that thickness? Or perhaps it's not very important at all, and that makes give us more comfort in how we apply the model and ultimately design and build the chemical isolation layer. We can also use a model in the, we're obviously trying to predict forward in time. We're trying to evaluate, say, at 100 years of a lifetime of a CAP, what sort of performance do we expect? Well, during that interim period, we have an opportunity to then evaluate how well is the monitoring data we're collecting compared to what we were predicting. And so those are all effective uses of a model, and we'll talk about, how to do some of those. So first of all, why CAP models? There are surface water models, there are groundwater models, but neither of them focus a lot of attention on the sediment, near surface sediment environment itself, which is where the CAP is operating. It's where contaminants are migrating, where we're worried about benthic organisms. It's just that 10 to 20 centimeters, sometimes as much as a meter, where we're focusing all of attention with our CAP model. Groundwater models can tell us a lot about the water that's coming to our surface water interface or our sediment water interface. The river models or the water surface water models can tell us a lot about the behavior, the processes in the surface water. But if we're looking at detail at that sediment water interface where a lot of processes are going on, it's a perfect storm of physics, chemistry, and biology that are occurring in those upper tens of centimeters in sediments, and that's where a CAP model comes into play. Some of those processes, certainly there's a potential for erosion in evaluating that. That does go into the domain of the surface water modeling. But in general, we try hard not to have erosion. We try to design, say, an armoring layer that you saw some examples of in a way that it will be protective even under high flow events. And if there's one thing that we can describe pretty well, it's the erodibility of non-cohesive sediments. And that's what we make our armor layers from. We don't do it out of cohesive sediments. We're making them out of materials that are non-cohesive, and we understand when they're going to erode. So we're going to ultimately, our purpose there, and we don't need a CAP model to do that, is just to ensure that our armoring layer is protective into the max flow. Often the bigger challenge is figuring out what type of flow should we protect against. But once we have a stable layer, that's where all the processes of the chemical isolation layer and the modeling of that chemical isolation layer come into play. The mobile phase of the contaminants are the pore water. There's a lot of redox changes that occur in the near surface that could affect chemistry. We have the organisms that really dominate behavior in the upper few centimeters, and they're often the object of what we're trying to protect as well. The benthic boundary layer, which does relate what's happening at the surface to the overlying water. And there's some other processes like hyperreic exchange. So there's just a few of the processes that occur at the sediment water interface, and those are what CAP models are designed to describe. Recovery is one of those models. It's from the Corps of Engineers, and it breaks our sediment up into various layers. The surface layer, because of bioturbation activity, is generally assumed to be well mixed. And then there are other layers that have a variety of processes: transport between dissolved and particulate fractions, advection, diffusion, deposition, erosion. All of these things can affect the recovery model. We also have CAPSIM, which is a model that we've been working on for a number of years at Texas Tech, and it interacts through a graphical user interface, and a lot of people find that pretty helpful. And so it's probably the most widely used model at this point for describing the future behavior of a CAP and the effectiveness of a chemical isolation layer. Again, it breaks up the sediments into different layers that have different functions and different processes, and tries to describe the chemical behavior in each of those systems. CAPSIM actually has an awful lot of capability that most people don't really use, such as the ability to model multiple reactions simultaneously that are coupled. So, for example, you could use it to model biogeochemical conditions. We've used it to model perhaps 15 simultaneous coupled relationships that relate the various redox sensitive species and contaminants that respond to those. But again, most people don't really make use of that. It can model sorption kinetics or equilibrium. Most people only deal with equilibrium. But there is that opportunity if you're worried about, for example, whether the activated carbon you added is going to have significant limitations because you use granular carbon versus powdered. You can assess those sort of issues within the CAPSIM. It also includes some typical properties of some commercial materials like Aquagate or some reactive core mat, for example. Those are available there, and it has a lot of built-in default values that are useful as well. But it is ultimately a tool to try to predict the rate and movement of contaminant migration, the behavior long term of these contaminants through chemical isolation layer. So, one of the most important questions is, what contaminants or what processes are the most important? Where should you focus your attention if you're trying to define and refine parameters? Certainly, identifying which contaminants you want to try to simulate, those that are strongly sorbing versus those that are not as sorbing, certainly have very different behavior. So, identifying that contaminant, what is going to control both exposure and risk, and what's going to control the design of your CAP is pretty critical. What concentration should we design against? Is it perhaps a maximum or perhaps a 85% tile in the concentration distribution? Defining and getting agreement with stakeholders as to what you're going to employ for your contaminant and the concentrations you're trying to protect against are key. Certainly, the sorption coefficients of those contaminants in the chemical isolation layer are key. In general, we rarely try to design CAPs that are actually reactive. Instead, they're slowing migration primarily through sorption. So understanding those sorption coefficients are key, as well as relating our sediment concentrations to what's in the interstitial water, which is where it's mobile and moving through a CAP. Because the movement through the water is the key, those groundwater upwelling rates are a very important model input and one of the most difficult to assess. If we have a strongly upwelling groundwater system moving into the water, a gaining stream at very high rates, it's going to have a completely different effect on the contaminants in the chemical isolation layer than if that is negligible. Sediment deposition is something that we often don't take into account because we're unsure how well it will work far into the future. But if there's any significant deposition, it can very much enhance the performance of a chemical isolation layer. Recognize that much of the recovery we often see at sediment sites are associated with natural deposition and natural recovery. And of course, that's just isolating over time the contaminants with a natural cap. And so knowing what those might be could be very beneficial. Again, we often don't make use of that because we're a little uncertain as to how well they be, or we're trying to do a conservative design. And of course, where we're going to evaluate the cap design is also extremely important. And one of the issues is not necessarily evaluating our design right at the sediment water interface. At the sediment water interface, those concentrations that we see there are strongly controlled by how fast we move contaminants from the surface to the overlying water. So that benthic boundary layer. And so I can modify the performance of my cap a lot by changing the performance movement in the water. Well, that's not designing our chemical isolation layer. That's why we don't necessarily use that to estimate and evaluate our designs. So it can be important, that intensity, the sediment water exchange, but in general, it's not very important, and it's especially not very important where we're often set our compliance point. The kinetics of sorption onto strongly sorbing phase, this is the granular versus powdered activated carbon, can be important, but only in those systems where there is a very dynamics, that is, high upwelling, very thin layers, low amounts of carbon. Like if I'm trying to put 1% activated carbon into a thin layer of sediment with pretty high upwelling rates, kinetics of that sorption could be important. If I'm looking at a thick layer or a lot of carbon, not so important. If we are dealing with non-conservative contaminants where there is some reaction, it'd often be important. It will be useful at least to identify what those kinetics of those reactions are, and certainly CAPSIM can take that into play. We often assume that these compounds are long-lived and they don't react, and that's just a measure of conservatism. But when we're looking at decadal or even longer timescales, a lot of these contaminants will, in fact, react over time. And taking that into account, at least in a sensitivity analysis, could be useful and important. I think it's always important to recognize when we're using a model, we break in the capping modeling effort, we tend to break up areas into sub areas. That is, we're looking at specific areas where a particular design of a cap might be appropriate, and we're worried about how an area is going to respond, basically dealing with contaminant information, maybe at a few points within that area. But the overall performance is about capping as an aerial remedy. We're trying to protect the waterway, and it's not a point-by-point remedy, even though we often design it and model it as such. It's also important to recognize that a cap is not like a balloon. If we core it, for example, to see how it's behaving after 10 years, it's not going to let all the contaminants out in general. So, again, we're looking at performance over an overall area. And as a result, statistical measures, for example, a 85th percentile of a contaminant concentration as a design remedy is often quite appropriate, not necessarily design the entire site for the worst case. I mentioned before being careful of interpreting concentrations of the cap water interface right at the interface. What happens there is often controlled by what happens in the water. And so we're designing to that, not necessarily designing the chemical isolation layer. The flux can be a little better than concentration, and that's the point that the last box on this slide is trying to get at. Now, the question of model uncertainty and sensitivity, Certainly, we don't know all the model parameters. Some of them are more important than others. And how do we determine that? And how did I identify which were the most important parameters? It's one of the most important and most useful aspects of the model. We can evaluate the sensitivity of the results to these specific parameters. And then we can focus our attention on those parameters that are most uncertain, but also because of their uncertainty, the results are sensitive to their values. And those are the values in the upper right. Things that are uncertain but don't really affect our conclusions aren't very important. Things that are that we know very well, obviously they don't hurt our conclusions very well. But again, those that we are both uncertain and that affect our results is where we need to focus our attention. And the model is a perfect tool to play what-if games to evaluate that. So I was going to show one slide, and you've seen some others, but just as an illustration, the sort of things that you get out of CAPSIM or recovery is predictions of concentrations, for example, over time. But you could also use it to predict fluxes in a given CAP environment. You could get it to different contaminants. You could look at solid concentrations. You could look at solid mixing. There's a variety of outputs that it can calculate for you. And again, you can use this to evaluate sensitivity. How long is it going to take to migrate through my cap? What if I change that mixture that's in that cap, the amendment? How is that going to affect the results? These are all games that you can play with the modeling. With that, let's stop and open it up for a round of questions.
All right, thanks, Danny. As Danny mentioned, we have reached our first Q&A break of the training. We do have a couple questions I can ask the trainers at this break. Just a reminder, you can use the Q&A pod at any time during today's training, and we will have one more chance to answer your questions at the end of the training today. So the first question we have, what type of monitoring is required once taps are in place? What are the cost estimates for continued monitoring? Sorry.
Actually, where we have a monitoring section at the end. So maybe hold that question.
Sure. Yeah, I was going to mention that we were probably going to get into this later in the training. So we'll see if that question does get answered. If not, we will return to it at the end of the training. Another question I have for the trainers. Is the goal of a sediment cap designed to perform significantly better than natural recovery?
Well, this is Danny, and I guess I might just suggest that if you're trying to manage the risks at a site and you find that natural recovery is insufficient or not moving fast enough, I mean, that's exactly why we pursue some sort of remedy, such as capping. And so I would say the answer to that is in general, yes, because if we were happy with natural recovery, we probably wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be doing the design and we wouldn't be doing the cap.
All right, thanks, Danny. I'm just going to ask one more question before we continue with the training. How much does the type of climate affect the type of cap that is used at a particular site?
Well, doesn't seem like anybody's jumping on that one. So, again, I will have some comments. And there certainly are some regional issues. But when you're talking about climate in this context, I'm assuming you're referring to conditions such as in the north, where you might have icing over in the winter. That's an issue that in some specific areas, the formation of ice dams can compromise a cap. In general, I would say that with a few ex specific assumptions or exceptions, such as that regional climate has pretty minimal impact on the cap design. But there are some specific examples, and I just alluded to one.
All right, thanks, Danny. I don't see any other. Oh, there was one more question that came in. One second. Should CAP still be used whenever there is cleanup that meets required state levels for an NFA, but there is still contaminant within the material? Don't know if the trainers have any response to that question. Just came in.
I think this is Deirdre. I think that typically, like when we're designing a cap, we generally try to design it to meet a certain criteria. So, if the cleanup already ad addressed the concentrations in your sediment are already less than your targets, then a cap is probably not needed. But if there is still contaminant in your material, you would just and you want to address it, you would just need to know what concentration is acceptable, maybe from a risk perspective, and then design the cap to meet that criteria. I'm not sure if that answered the question or not.
All right, thanks, Deirdre. Emily, I think, asked that question. If you have any follow-up questions, just continue to use that Q&A pod and we will hopefully get to them. All right, I will go ahead and continue on with the training. So thank you all for interacting with the Q&A pod, and we will, like I mentioned, have one more opportunity at the end to answer more questions. So I will now turn this over to Mike Ellis from Bahr Engineering to get us into the next module.
Thank you, Taylor. So this next module will discuss constructability considerations for the cap, or I should say the chemical isolation layer. So far we've discussed how to design a cap and important considerations when evaluating an appropriate cap. In this section, we'll focus on how to kind of incorporate that design into construction specifications and how to conduct appropriate quality control during construction. Next slide, please. So just this kind of sequence reiterates what I mentioned on the previous slide. So important things that we'll discuss from this module are construction, quality assurance, quality control, and things to document during the construction of a cap that would be important to incorporate in a construction completion report or as-built drawings for the project. Next slide, please. So the figure on this slide is one that we've shown previously, a conceptual figure of a sediment cap with a chemical isolation layer. And some of the most important constructability considerations are listed here regarding material placement and mixing. And if you could just imagine, a sediment cap with multiple layers like the conceptual figure has here, if each of those layers is not placed in accordance with what the design calls for, either because of mixing with an underlying layer or placement spread, that issue kind of gets compounded and can lead to implementation of sediment caps that don't behave as designed because they weren't constructed as designed. So really the important considerations we're laying out here are just to ensure that the constructed cap is consistent with the intention of the design and that it's going to perform as designed. So in regards to material placement, a couple things to keep in mind, and we'll go into in a little bit more detail, are material spread, and that can be upstream to downstream, but also, riverward to shoreward, or various directions depending on the flow environment that material is being placed. And then consolidation or mixing of materials with underlying layers can reduce the effective concentration of cap layers. So that's an important consideration to evaluate when looking at placement methods for each layer. Next slide, please. The image on this slide shows what you would want to see in an amended material for chemical isolation layer. So there's materials that we would typically amend. So this example is sand amended with granular activated carbon particles. And as you can see in the conceptual image, the sand particles are well mixed with the activated carbon particles, and the activated carbon particles are well distributed within the sand. And that's ideally what we want to see when the material is placed, but getting there can be difficult. So some important things to consider, both in the design and implementation, are the dose requirements. And the dosing requirements, while important to make sure that the amendment is there's sufficient mass or volume of the amendment that will meet the intent of the design. The specifications also need to be written such that verifying that amendment dose in the field is plausible or feasible to do. And then the amendment also needs to be well mixed and distributed, like is shown in the conceptual image. And there are amendments that can be affected by mixing or placement, either by separation or actually impacting the integrity of the amendment itself. So being able to verify that the placed material is consistent with the integrity you want to see as per the design is an important consideration, both in specifying placement methods and in developing a construction quality assurance plan. Next slide, please. So there's a number of different placement methods contractors can utilize for placement of sediment cap material. This slide and then the following slide will highlight a few of the common and then proprietary placement methods that you may see in the field. So first, starting to the far left on the slide is a concrete bucket. So this is a fairly low cost method using commonly available equipment, and it can be placed from a shoreline or barge, which is helps for site access. But the disadvantages are that a crew needs to access the bucket, and then there's some limitations when it comes to lift control. Another common placement method is use of an excavator, that's shown on the second image from the left. So this is obviously a fairly commonly available piece of equipment. It can be utilized from shoreline or from a barge. Disadvantages associated with excavator placement are that there is difficulty in controlling the lift, and then fairly low production rates compared to some other methods. A clamshell bucket is another potential placement method. This is very common in the marine industry and can have higher production rates. But as you can see on the image for this option, it typically would utilize a crane and then a barge for transporting material closer to the clamshell and crane. So there are challenges associated with overhead obstructions and just being able to get that equipment into tight areas. On the far right-hand side, there's an image of a conveyor delivery. So this can be a really efficient method with high production rates. It also allows you to have some pretty good control over the lift because the material is being spread out, or you can kind of spread it out with by varying where the conveyor is being placed. The disadvantage is that it can be difficult to actually get material into the hopper for the conveyor. And for sites with tight access or longer, I guess, placement areas, that can be difficult. Next slide, please. So there's a number of proprietary placement methods that marine contractors who commonly do this work have. We've included examples from J.F. Brennan and Sevenson on this slide. On the left-hand side of the slide is the example from J.F. Brennan. So in both of these examples, they're using hydraulic delivery of cap materials to a barge. And that just allows for very efficient delivery of those materials to the capping barge, and limits downtime. So the advantages here are that you get a higher production rate and then also more evenly distributed placement of materials. So the material is spread out as shown in the curtain on the left-hand side of the figure there. But the equipment itself can be hard to get into tighter project locations. So that's a limitation. And the example on the right-hand side of the slide is a similar setup from Sevenson, but they have hydraulic delivery of the cap material and then spreading the material as it's hydrated or wetted. Whereas the Brennan example dries the material prior to placement. So similar advantages and disadvantages for the Sevenson capping method, just slightly different based on contractor preferences. Next slide, please. So wanted to talk through some key considerations for placement and then material loss as well. And if you, there we go. Thank you. So for placement accuracy and tracking, the equipment and operator experience using that equipment are really important in being able to accurately place material. So evaluating contractors' proposed personnel for the work, along with their proposed equipment and tracking methods, is important to make sure they're thinking through the steps and personnel needed to achieve the requirements of the design. And then there are quality control measures that, as engineers and scientists, we want to implement to verify that the cap was built as designed. So we have those listed out here, and you want to consider where the lifts are placed, the quantity that's placed in the uniformity of the material placement, and some of the best practices that are commonly utilized to do that include RTK GPS, bathymetric surveys, and direct measurements. And I'll talk about those in more detail on the next slide. And then key considerations to think about to evaluate material loss include the material properties, the equipment accuracy, and the placement conditions. So for material properties, some things to consider are the density of the material being placed and whether it has a higher density and a tendency to sink fairly quickly, so less opportunity for the material to spread, or a lower density. And a lower sinking rate, which could increase the spread of the material when it's being placed. And this can come into, I guess, more consideration when you have an amended cap. So the amendment in the material that is being amended may have different densities. So the rate at which they fall out within the water column would be different. And therefore, there could be some settling or separation that occurs during placement of the amended cap. And making sure there's I should say there's ways to make sure that that doesn't happen based on how it's placed or the state in which it is placed. But evaluating that the in-place mixture is consistent with the design would be an important consideration if you do have an amended cap. Next slide, please. So this slide highlights some of the typical quality assurance methods for verifying cap placement. And one caveat that I wanted to mention before getting into each of these methods is that there really isn't a one-size-fits-all solution to projects. These are options to consider when developing a quality assurance plan, but the quality assurance plan itself needs to be specific to the project objectives and how the cap is designed. So these are, I guess, can be considered a menu of options rather than a one-size-fits-all. Bathymetric surveys are really common in capping projects. They are typically integrated into quality assurance plans in some way, shape, or form. They allow for area-wide analysis. And then another benefit here is that it's typical to have contractors who have capabilities performing bathymetric surveys fairly local and readily available. The disadvantage with this approach is that it gives you the sediment surface but does not tell you any information about settling or mixing, or if an amendment was used, whether that amendment separated out during placement. Another option is a sub-bottom profile. And there's an example of a result from a sub-bottom profile survey shown on this slide, but that technique can provide a profile of sediment bed that allows you to differentiate where there are different materials. So depending on the material properties, you could be able to tell where the material type switches within the sediment profile. It can be fairly approximate. It can be kind of tricky to parse out accurate results depending on the environment that it's being utilized in. And then a disadvantage here is that it is location specific, not kind of an area-wide analysis. Sediment profile imaging is another option where you actually take a visual image of the sediment profile, as the name alludes to. And that allows you to get, you know, kind of a more accurate picture of what's happening within the sediment profile. Can allow you to evaluate whether the amendment used in the cap was well mixed after placement or if there was any separation of material. Some disadvantages with this option are that it is location specific. So this is a, you know, one specific point and not an area-wide evaluation. And depending on the materials used for the sediment cap, there could be limitations in the thickness or depth that you're able to profile. The settling pans can be another option for evaluating placement. So this is a pan or bucket that's placed into the area that is actively being capped. And then removed after capping so that anything collected in the pan or bucket as shown in this photo can be evaluated against the design requirements. So it does give you kind of a snapshot of what the cap placement would look like without needing to take a core or a profile through the cap. But some disadvantages, again, are that it's a very location specific. And that it's not able to evaluate any mixing because you're placing that pan over the underlying cap layer. And then finally, collection of cores is another way to verify placed conditions of materials. So similar to the sediment profile imaging, you're getting an actual look at what the placed cap material looks like and allows you to evaluate mixing. Some disadvantages with it are that It's subject to compression as you're taking the course. So the actual thickness may be a little bit different than what it is in the water column because it's getting compressed as the core is being collected. And that, again, is another very location-specific option. Next slide, please. So kind of to wrap things up, we wanted to just highlight some of the important concepts and considerations related to constructability that need to be accounted for during design and construction of sediment caps. The first is to evaluate the proposed equipment. And as scientists and engineers, typically we don't like to get into means and methods for how things are constructed. And typically that is up to contractors to decide, but it is important in this scenario to look at what is being proposed and give it a truth check as to whether it is likely to meet the design requirements and ask the appropriate questions to make sure you don't get in a situation where during construction there's back and forth about whether or not the design requirements are reasonably achievable. And then control placement of layers can be really important to limit mixing of layers. As was highlighted earlier in this training, the layer thickness is an important variable in modeling and designing sediment caps. So making sure that the place thickness meets the design is important. And you can do that by evaluating how placement of the layers is occurring. An amendment delivery can be another tricky one when it comes to placement of sediment caps. Activated carbon, being a common amendment, does have a density that's typically different than the material it's being amended to. So separation is a concern, and you want to make sure that delivery of that amendment to the as-placed sediment cap is consistent with your design requirements. And then building a construction quality assurance plan that allows you to verify that dosage is achieved in the field both before and after mixing or after placement. And then finally, just a reminder that a robust quality assurance program is important for sediment cap construction. Most often, these are constructed underwater, which just makes the verification of as-built conditions more difficult than other construction that occurs on land. So remember to evaluate options based on what your objectives are for the project and kind of think about a multi-layered approach for construction quality assurance. I think that's it for me.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up here to talk about the monitoring and maintenance. You've gone through this entire process, done all this modeling, all this evaluation, construction, and you do want to make sure that everything is working the way it's supposed to. A cap is really like any other built infrastructure, it needs to be performing. And it needs to be in the location where you expect it to be and doing what you want it to do. So there's kind of a bunch of reasons why we monitor in order to assess the performance of the cap. Obviously, you want to compare it to, the dimensions and the quality of what was designed. Deirdre went through a bunch of things that I'll touch on again briefly here to see whether what is going on in the surface of your sediment layer now is chemical migration coming up through the cap, which would be a performance concern, or whether it's deposition from background. What is your natural recovery, which could be deposition of clean sediment, do you need to maintain in any way, and what are your long-term objectives? How long will your cap last? Do you need to do any repairs, that kind of thing? So obviously, sampling is one way to look at your cap performance. And this is sort of a basic layers here, where you, under your water, you have your biologically active zone, and then underneath it, your chemical isolation layer over the source material. And you do want to make sure that you have adequate thickness of your different layers, and that they're approximately what you expect them to be and what you've modeled with that predicts successful cap performance. And if something is a problem, if you're starting to see breakthrough, for example, in your chemical isolation layer, you can possibly take action before you have a problem with contamination moving up into your biologically active zone or discharging to your water column. This is kind of what Deirdre went over, so I won't belabor it. And it's kind of a hard thing to wrap your head around if you're looking at it really quickly. But the first one on the left is, yeah, as you get deeper, your concentration is getting higher. And then with your shallower, where you want to be protected, it's getting lower. If you are getting lower but not lower enough, that could mean your isolation function is not operating well. And if it's getting better and then suddenly getting worse, as shown on the right, that tells you there's something coming from the other side, from the top, and you have recontamination. And that is not necessarily a cap performance problem, but it could be an overall remedy performance problem if the background was not adequately characterized, and you've designed this cap that's doing its job, and then you're ending up with a same type of problem. How do we actually measure the chemical isolation performance? Deirdre mentioned pore water. That's kind of your gold standard here. If you go into the isolation layer and your dissolved phase is clean of the contaminants that you are remediating for, that's a great indicator that your cap is functioning, that you're not having breakthrough of soluble contamination. Solid phase, also pretty common, but it doesn't necessarily tell you how contamination is partitioning between solid and aqueous, so it's not as useful. Surface water, honestly, most agencies really do want you to look at surface water, but because surface water tends to so rapidly dilute anything that might be coming up through your cap, it's unlikely to really indicate whether there's a performance problem. I mean, maybe if you have a really lazy system like a wetland with very shallow water and you have a big problem, you might see it, but in general, you wouldn't expect that to be particularly useful. And then biota, that is also a very complicated thing to evaluate. We had a lot of heated discussions in our team meetings about fish tissue sampling. Everyone loves fish tissue sampling, but the truth is that fish move around a lot, and in most systems, if anything you find in fish is not going to be reflective of what's coming up through your cap. And even if it is, fish have typically such a slow half-life over which they will eliminate contaminants. And with things like bioaccumulators, PCBs, pesticides, and so forth, you can have a very, very decades even before your system starts to show the benefits of remediation. So you can look at it. Certainly, if you looked at biometric monitoring of your biological community on your cap rather than the chemical concentrations in biota, that might be a much more rapidly recovering criterion that you could look at. And it's always nice to see those bugs back hopping. So, like anything else, a cap can need a little love over the years. Why would you do that? Well, a lot of reasons. First of all, as we first just discussed, you might have breakthrough, in which case you need to kind of figure out, which of your layers may not be optimally performing. Things may start to consolidate. And they're getting crushed, you get subsidence. We talked about bathymetric measurements, looking at the elevation of your sediment layer, and that can tell you a lot about what's going on the bottom there. Maybe you have some kind of instability. And somebody asked about climate, and certainly, your climate zone, as Danny said, is not really important, but if you have a marine environment, and you are subject to a lot of storm events, certainly that is something that could affect your cap's integrity, as can a lot of vehicular traffic going on around the area. If you're close to a navigational channel or for any other reason, there is physical disturbance, it can mess up the cap. So those are all reasons why maybe you might need to go in and do some repair, and that's fine. It is infrastructure and it needs to be maintained. So overall, the point here is just it's not once and done. You should have a plan for what you're going to monitor, why you're going to monitor it, and how your monitoring program reflects your cap performance and its function within your larger remedial action objective for your site area. And there's all kinds of things from monitoring to pore water to physical evaluation that can tell you how you're doing. And you may need to change those over time. It can be somewhat of an adaptive management approach where you need to circle back, or you just may have certain things built into your long-term plan that say, we're going to go out every X number of months or years and look at A, B, and C. And then as Deirdre talked about, your cap is an area-wide solution. If you have a little bit of subsidence or some erosion right on an edge somewhere or on a shoreline, that doesn't mean that your entire infrastructure is failing. So there's no need for it to be absolutely perfect. You just want to make sure overall that it is functioning. And with that, we're ready to wrap this up.
All right. I'd like to thank all of my fellow team members who presented today. Our goal for this sediment capping guidance was to expand on the 2014 sediment remediation guidance by developing a comprehensive understanding of the design, construction, and long-term monitoring and maintenance of caps, with a focus on the chemical isolation function. So, to recap, designing the chemical isolation function is an iterative process that begins with understanding remedial goals and objectives. We use those objectives to develop chemical design criteria specific to the contaminant fate and transport pathways within the cap. Chemical design criteria are the what, the where, and the when, or for how long, that serve as the conditions that the design must meet to satisfy the remedial objectives. Once these design criteria are established, cap design involves selecting appropriate capping materials and thicknesses that can achieve those design criteria. In addition to the chemical design criteria, it's important that the cap also satisfy other design factors, such as physical constraints, permitting and other regulatory requirements, and it must remain constructible. Two modeling tools are available and were discussed that have been developed specifically to support capping design. and these modeling tools can be used to estimate how well various cap configurations and materials will fulfill the design criteria. After the design is completed, it's important to convey cap construction requirements clearly to contractors and to employ construction quality assurance measures to verify that the built cap is consistent with the design. Finally, it's important to factor in how cap performance will be monitored, potentially in addition to other effectiveness monitoring approaches for the remedy. We recommend that cap performance data be compared with predetermined maintenance triggers so that it's clear upfront when cap maintenance should be considered in order to ensure the cap will continue to meet its design objectives well into the future. With that, I'll hand it back to our moderator for another question and answer opportunity.
All right, thanks, Ashley. Yeah, we have reached our last Q&A of the training today. We do have a couple questions for the trainers. First question, how is a geomembrane layer cap typically repaired for animal burrows?
I'll just jump in. So the caps that we're talking about in this training are subaqueous, so they're underwater. So the burrowing organisms are going to be like benthic organisms like chironomids or worms, and they don't usually burrow that deep. And where burrowing does occur, you try to, you know, keep maybe keep that layer deeper than the burrowing does.
All right, thanks, Deirdre. A question I have here from Mike. If you use core collection for QA/QC, how do you prevent contamination or mixing between layers?
I'm guessing this question is referring to maybe like once you remove the core and that portion of the cap kind of not being constructed as designed, but I think typically that core is considered incidental, like the actual core that's being removed from the cap. There may be special considerations where removing even just that small of a piece of the cap wouldn't be acceptable, and if that's the case, you know, core collection wouldn't be a recommended approach for quality assurance in that scenario. Hope that answers the question, but let me know if not.
All right, thanks, Mike. I don't see any other open questions in the Q&A pod. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up the training. If any more questions do enter, I will ask our trainers before we completely wrap up. So thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document. We would like to hear back from you, so please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that's linked on this last slide, and I'm also going to drop it in the chat now. Filling out the feedback form and certifying that you participated will allow you to receive a certificate of completion by email. If you need further clarification on the answers or would like to ask more questions, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. And then I do see one more question in here that I'll ask, and then I will officially say thank you and goodbye. Who is usually responsible for monitoring? Does the job fall on public or private sectors? I assume that was the question asked. It says public/private sectors.
And I think it's going to depend who the responsible party was for the remediation. I mean, in my experience, it's been private sector, but that's because that's most of the work I do.
All right, thanks, Tamara. And with that, I think that wraps up our training for today. So thanks again, everyone, for questions and interacting with the Q&A pod today. We hope to see you in the future at other ITRC trainings. And thanks again to our expert trainers for being here and volunteering the guidance document and in the training. Bye, everyone.